Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, Your Book listeners. I really hope you're enjoying these archive treats as much as I am, and that you're discovering some new books through some of our old friends. And on the theme of new books from old friends, I'd like to tell you about a brand new book from your old friend me. My new novel, Pity Party, is coming this summer. It's the story of Catherine, a woman who lives by the rules, ticks all the boxes, and prepares for the worst, even while she hopes for the best. Then the worst actually happens, and as she tries to navigate life as a young widow, it turns out she was not prepared at all. Pity Party is a romantic comedy about grief. It's a satire about trying to be a good person in the 21st century, and it's a love story with a twist. Its fans include Marion Keyes, Nina Stibbe, and Katherine Heine, and hopefully you. Pity Party is out on the 11th of July, and I'd love to invite friends of the Your Book podcast to pre-order from wherever you get your books. I know quite a few of you have pre-ordered already, and I am so, so grateful. It really is the best way to support an author, and it's an incredibly helpful way to show bookshops and publishers that you're excited about reading the book. You can pre-order from absolutely anywhere, including Amazon, Waterstones, and bookshop.org. If you pre-order directly from your local independent bookshop, I will arrange a signed, personalised, dedicated book plate for you. And if you order directly from my local bookshop, the Margate Bookshop, we can send your personalised copy straight to you. They deliver across the UK. There's a link to order Pity Party in the show notes. If you go to my newsletter, creativeconfidenceclinic.substack.com, you can have an exclusive look at the very first chapter. Lauren Bravo says, Pity Party is the funniest book you'll read this year. I hope it makes you laugh. Hello, and welcome to Your Booked. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your host and the author of The Sisterhood, a love letter to the women who have shaped us. My debut novel, Insatiable, is coming in spring 2021, and it's available for pre-order now. So we're doing something a little bit different, as we can't record beside people's bookshelves at the moment. This is our shelf isolation series, and we'll be talking to favourite former guests, friends of the Your Booked family, and some of the people that we admire the most about how they're using books, or not, to get through this strange time. Our first shelf isolator is the writer, comedian and actor Sarah Pascoe. Her brilliant books, Animal and Sex, Power, Money are available now. I have been a huge fan of Sarah's for pretty much as long as I've loved comedy, and I'm so excited to hear that she's working on some fiction at the moment. We talked about stealing library books, elaborate lies about hamsters, and the book that made Sarah cry so hard she had to pretend she was in the middle of a divorce. Look at your beautiful bookshelves.
I know, they're lovely. This is the one advantage of doing stuff at home now, is I can sit in front of my books. It makes me very happy.
Very soon. So what can I see behind me? Oh, first of all, I was wondering, are you reading much at the moment? Are you finding it's quite soothing, or is it harder to concentrate?
Well, at the beginning of the lockdown, I wasn't well, and you know that thing where your head is very cloudy, so even though you're lying in bed, you find you can't concentrate. So at the beginning, I was really frustrated. Like, I've got this free time, I want to be able to read. But then, about 3 weeks ago, it kind of clicked, and I realised that maybe the books that I would read normally aren't the right books for a lockdown. So I'm really kind of splurging. Sometimes I have a thing where I should be reading lots of non-fiction and kind of researching things, but I'm just reading lots and lots of novels and kind of memoirs and things like that. So I'm the current book I'm reading, I'm just about to finish Bernardine Evaristo's novel.
I loved it so
which
much.
I'm really enjoying. It's a good lockdown book because it's so social. It feels like you're making lots of new friends and having lots of conversations with brilliant women. And yeah, it's really good.
I've not thought about that. That's such a good point. There's so much kind of joyful noise in that book. Because I know there are lots of books that I want to read and think, oh, I just need time to sit down with it. And I never find the time. And I guess we're all finding the time right now.
Have you found time for them now?
Yeah,
I've just finished a proof that I got sent. It's coming out in July. It's called Belladonna and the writer is Anbara Salam, and I think it's her second novel. Really enjoyed it.
Oh, that's great. I think the lockdown timed really well for lots of people with the Hilary Mantel third book, because that was such a massive doorstop. And so I started reading that at the beginning of the lockdown, and I'm about to go back to it.
Oh, wow. Are you a fan? Have you read all of those books?
Yes. Yeah, I read all of her novels. I love her.
But I love that you have so many books, because occasionally people say, oh, I only kind of read on Kindle, or I give everything away. Yeah. Do you keep all your books, or do you give them away and lend them?
I've always been obsessive about it. And so when I was a teenager, this is awful, but I didn't have any money. I used to shoplift from the library so I would read books and I didn't want to give them back, so I kept them, which is obviously very illegal and wrong, but this is before they had the scanners when you left, so I would just put them in my bag.
So what was the first time you did it? Can you remember the first book you kept?
Well, it would have been, I loved lots of storybooks, so I loved Enid Blyton and all of those books, so I was relatively young. So it would have been kind of 9, 10, 11. I reckon started at around 11 with Enid Blyton, and then kind of, I really liked storybooks. I loved Lynn Reed Banks. I don't know if you ever read her when you were a teenager.
Oh, I remember her so vividly. And those books as well that were always like in the classroom. And you know those names of writers, and they become like these celebrities because you stare at them all year long.
Yeah, that's it. So she wrote a book about a hamster called I, Houdini, who could escape from anywhere, and I really wanted a hamster. And reading her book, I started lying to a teacher at school that I did have a hamster, and I would always, my show and tell, my stories about the weekend always involved my adventures with this hamster that I didn't have. Yeah, I used to steal books because I couldn't bear giving them back. I wanted to keep them, but I also had to hide them because obviously they weren't mine. And I'm not condoning that at all. I know it was bad, but the root of it was a compulsion to be able to show what I had read and to look at it and remember what I'd read. I moved out at 18 and then I went to university at 20. And sometimes it's really hard lugging books around. And as I got more and more books, I had to start leaving them at my mum's house in boxes. And I just worried about them all the time, like getting damp and damaged. And then I bought a flat last year. And so for the first time in my life, we're all together, me and my books. And that's why it's such such a happy thing for me.
So those books, I thought, that has been years in the making.
Yes. Although I don't keep all books. I read a lot of crime thrillers and I don't tend to keep those. I give them to the charity shop because other people like to read them. And I think I'm probably a little bit snobby.
I think that once you know, because I guess there are things that you read because you want to know who done it. And when you know
what happened. Yeah.
Who are your favourite crime writers?
I really like Kathy Reichs, who does a lot with kind of, bones that have been kind of old, really old skeletons. I guess I find like forensic pathology really interesting, and she was a forensic pathologist. So her book's really good. And Val McDermid is also brilliant.
I love about your own books is the very sort of, you know, the smart science and the way that you really, you know, go into that. And that is that sort of part of that passion, that interest in sort of how bodies work and what bodies do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think I love biology and also understanding why things happen. Having someone explain to you, well, that's because of this, or this causes that. I think there's deep pleasure, isn't there, in kind of scientific explanation.
What's the best thing that you've discovered? Or are there any kind of, you know, weird scientific facts that are from your reading where you're like, I will never forget that?
I'm reading a book at the moment. So my non-fiction book, I haven't finished it. It's called Behave. And it's by Robert Potulsky. And it's about... basically it's about why human beings do really bad things and how it happens. And the chapter I'm reading at the moment is about us and them and how humans as an ape create a tribe and people are outside it. And that's so fascinating because it kind of underlines everything. I think it's the most interesting thing, especially with what's going on with the virus, which really, really heightens the us and them. It's like, where did it come from? Who's to blame? Why are those people outside? Nurses and key workers, yes, they're in tribe, we like those people. and so that's a really interesting thing to think about at the moment. And there's lots and lots of obviously racial tension is absolutely the us and them. People decide, well, these people are, I pay my taxes and they're allowed to have this, and these people are enemies. So that's a really fascinating thing to think about.
I'd love to read that. I guess that's kind of what most novels are about as well, isn't it? That you see a group and you're either trying to keep someone out of your group or get into a different group.
With novels, it's absolutely an exercise in empathy, because essentially lots of the very good novels take a person that you don't think is like you and it makes you understand them. And so the person in the novel, it could be like American Psycho, where the person in the novel is an awful psychopath, or like Hannibal, those books where literally you're sympathizing and understanding someone who would eat you. And then at university, we used to study things like, so the importance of books like Uncle Tom's Cabin in kind of the end of slavery, because a white woman writing a book humanizing people, which obviously she shouldn't have had to do, but was a really incredible moment for people to understand, oh, we're all human beings.
And I suppose there are books like that that I think now, if one were to read Uncle Tom's Cabin with 2020 eyes, yeah, 2020 vision, it jars and it's...
Oh, absolutely. And also that uncomfortableness, the recent success and then backlash of American Dirt, I found so interesting, because I actually haven't read it, and I made a conscious choice not to read it because I read articles about why it what it was doing. But I have other friends, like there's a guy who runs a comedy club who messaged me going, I've just read this incredible book, I think you'd really like it. And then I thought he was joking when he said American Dirt, and I said, oh, are you joking? And he said, no. And I said, do you not know? Like, everyone's furious. And then he read up and he's like, oh no, I see it in a completely different light now. But that, I think, it's a really interesting change of the times, because those books, no one used to care when like a white man wrote Memoirs of a Geisha. But people were like, oh, what a great book. Not, this is cultural appropriation and someone out of somebody's culture assuming they can. So it's a really interesting debate in terms of what writers can write about legitimately.
And I sort of love that now a book still has the power to polarize and make people that angry, and a book's on the news. And there was a bit of me thinking, people are reading, this is great.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And also then people read to go a little bit, you know, like that D.H. Lawrence, Lady Chatterley's Lover, they're reading it because it's like, oh, I'm not supposed to, the bookshop's taken them off the shelves, I definitely want one.
I read a book that I got sent as a proof last year, and there was a similar sort of controversy about it later, called My Dark Vanessa.
I just read My Dark Vanessa.
What did you think?
I think it's very interesting, the idea of like grey areas, but I also think that the author really flagged that it's not that much of a grey area, even though that the woman who is the narrator doesn't not see herself as a victim, doesn't kind of align herself with other people, she doesn't see him as an abuser or a manipulative person. But as a reader, it's clearly that. And I thought all of their sexual interactions, I thought if she had just said, I enjoyed all of the sex with this man, that would have made it so much more complicated. Whereas she didn't, she was manipulated. There were cases that are written about which are clearly rape, where she either said no, was unconscious or was drunk. And she was in physical pain. So I actually thought that the author made it very clear, this is not okay. Like, it's not that grey an area.
What I found so moving and powerful and sad was, as an adult, the way she just couldn't, because to frame what had happened and to see it for what it was her life. And the betrayal as well. Did you read Three Women?
Yes, well, I was going to say, because that's a true story, I found that so... horrible, so because obviously I was gonna say it's so horribly realistic. The thing about the story in Three Women, which was true, what was recognised and written about so fantastically was how people who groom choose victims who aren't going to be believed, which my dark Vanessa didn't. He was grooming very intelligent, maybe outsiders, but very intelligent, and women, but very beautiful. Whereas I thought the whole thing with the person who experienced exactly the same situation in Three Women was literally in court when they said, why would I go for you? Like, why would I go for this, like, obese, unattractive person? It's about power over people, as we know. It's not about just lust you can't control. It's not Lolita. But it is, I think what is amazing is that as part of a cultural discussion, it doesn't have to all be through tabloid headlines. We can have incredible books written about it, which again are an emotional journey. And I think the reason that My Dark Vanessa might do really well is because I think it's a perfect book group book, because I think there's so many discussion points that she set out really well. And did you ever read Tampa?
I didn't read that. Who's it by?
So Tampa is about four years ago, and that's a female teacher grooming a male pupil. And so that it's really interesting because it's kind of actually, I've put it with a genre, it's about kind of female sexuality and ownership of sexuality. It's actually in that genre, but it's also, it's very unsettling, intentionally so. But it's interesting to read it within that kind of book, like My Dark Vanessa.
I do love those books that you can feel them shaking you at your core. And they stay with you, and the feelings stay with you in a strange way.
When I was reading Three Women, which I found a couple of times, I felt so overwhelmed, I almost felt nauseous because of the rawness about what was being explored. And I was reading it in the bath, and it's one of those times, it was the story about the girl and her teacher that I was reading at the time. And I remember thinking, I should maybe stop reading this because this isn't enjoyment, actually. And then I turned the page and a big black spider walked out, and it was between the pages. And it was so symbolic of how I felt about the book. Like, I couldn't put it down. It was like, but it was all, it's like it was creeping all over me and all through me, because even when I wasn't reading, I was like walking the dog, and I was thinking about the stories and the things that I'd just learned. It's such an incredible work, isn't it?
Oh, wow.
It's so powerful.
That is really, really eerie.
Yeah.
And I thought
really
it was
eerie.
Very interesting when it came out and the way it was published. And it was all, you know, this is like the most explicit book that's ever been written about female desire. But it wasn't the sex, it was the neediness and desire. I've been watching Normal People, and I read the book a while ago, and I loved it, but it's making me think about the book, and that, it seems like a real through line at the moment, all women wanting things and desiring things and being so, so frightened of saying, this is what I need, and feeling that's going to be silenced, and crushing that and squashing that, and feeling, doing all sorts of dreadful things to themselves because they're trying to hide that need.
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? But it is something I think will be reflected back on in publishing and maybe in media in general, and going, oh look, after 1997 we started really listening to women. Like, we really kind of like allowed them to speak. And then I remember with the beginning of podcasting that my two favorite podcasts were My Favorite Murder and Two Dope Queens. And I kept thinking, why am I fizzing every time I listen to them? Like, fizzing with like joy and interest and happiness. And I realized I never hear two women talking to each other, not interrupted by men. And that's nothing against men. It's not that I don't like or I'm not interested in, but I work in quite a male-dominated environment, which you just get used to. Never, ever do I just get to listen to women's conversations without men being a part of it, and sometimes it means the conversation's really different.
It's like hearing someone build a room, and that people are building something together. And maybe, I think you know much more than I do about this, but with that masculine thing, I think it's something that is social and not inherent or biological. But I think there's lots of being a man that's kind of, oh, I'm gonna be bigger and better, and I'm gonna either, my point will undermine yours, or I'm going to talk over you. And with women,
well, actually,
it's more symphonic.
Yeah, well, I think what it is actually is that you're right that there's a real social element, because in terms of being socially safe, lots of us have to adopt behaviours right from school. It's kind of peer taught. And for men, that is kind of be high status. That's where men are safest. A low status man is at risk in lots of ways, like in our evolution in the tribe, but also in a business meeting in his place of work, and if he's a teenager at school on the bus. Like, you have to look after yourself. And for girls, we learned, a lot of us learned, a different kind of social safety, which was about being quiet or fitting in. Don't say weird stuff, don't be loud. And that obviously isn't true of everyone. It's not a cut and paste boys and girls thing, but it is sometimes a thing that's kind of, we've learned and been, had a positive reinforcement and then carried on.
Do you have any sort of literary heroes or heroines or people in books that you'd like to be friends with, or people who sort of inspire you to speak up and be?
Oh, that's interesting. In terms of like fictional characters, I really loved, I always think about Sarah in Graham Greene's End of the Affair. I always thought she was really wonderful. Usually I don't think, oh, I'd like to be friends with that person, because usually in a novel, what you get to see is how flawed people are. So they're never like super attractive. Oh, I tell you the book that's really fantastic for a character you'd want to be friends with is Less.
Oh, I just read that.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't it a perfect book?
Oh, there's this detail where I think it's when he is possibly leaving Germany and he's really tired and he's accidentally taken sleeping pills in like too many.
Oh, okay.
And he thinks it's his reflection, and then the guy moves and he has that sort of, what's going on? And I just thought, that is so lifelike.
Yeah, and I think that character, everywhere he is, even in, when he's in the depths of misery and pain, you'd so happily have a cocktail with him, wouldn't you? Or sit next to him on a train, yeah.
There's a real genuine sweetness to that book, which I think is really rare. And I love that it's a sort of, it's a hero's journey and a love story.
Yeah, yeah. And it's cynical and romantic at the same time, which is, that's really difficult to combine both of those things.
I love the social observations and the politics. And it's very, it kind of reminds me of Evelyn Waugh. In places, the sort of, you know, very sweet kind of snippiness.
Yes. And also actually a little bit like Jane Austen, how Jane Austen would do like social commentary of like a group of people at a party.
Mm.
He absolutely does that to definitely. Go, well, this is going on and that's happening. And yeah.
Are you a Jane Austen fan? Do you have a favourite of hers?
I really love Jane Austen, but I didn't read her until after university. So I felt like I was always very late. I think I was really snobby about her before I read her, because I thought she would be dull. And I know she's Regency, but I thought in my head she was dull and Victorian, talking about bustles and why women needed men. And so when I did read her in my, I would have been like 26, 27, I was angry with because my two best friends, we all did an English degree together. And I was furious with them. I was like, why didn't you tell me she was funny? Like, if you tell me she was funny, I would have been so on board with this. My favourite is Pride and Prejudice, but not because I think it's the most amazing love story, because I don't. But in terms, again, the social commentary, the characters. Her mother, Mrs. Bennet, is one of the funniest characters in literature, if not the funniest. She's so funny.
Really, really funny. And Mr. Bennet is such a subtle villain. Lizzie needs him to give her some sort of like fibre, and he's just not really there.
Yeah, I know. And it's like, I know that the system lets women down, because, and obviously he'd failed as a father because his daughter's not only, well, because he's not financially provided for them and they can't inherit the house. So in a way he is such a loser, but he does have a kind of sweetness about him as well. He's a gentleman, isn't he? He's not kind of angry and aggressive. He's just, he fails by his weakness, I guess.
But I feel like he really relies on Lizzie to keep her mum in check, you know, because she just sort of lets things run away. And you're like, come on now, United Parenting Front.
Yes.
There's a lot of pressure on those kids. But I've always, always wondered about Mary, because she's so overlooked and she's always a punchline. I'm like, there's more to that girl. I have to know. And also, I would so love to write a sexy sequel where Lydia does run off with Wickham and they get into sort of Vanity Fair-esque troubles.
That's a great idea. There's a really interesting Guardian article about Mary, because a couple of years ago there were five projects. I don't even know if they got made or if they got made and we don't know. There were five films about Mary, because she's always obsessed people, because the little bits you do hear of her are so weird. And also quite often the less somebody speaks, the more that you project onto them. So actually it's often the Mary style character that people go, that's me. I'm that one.
The quiet one. There's more to me than you can ever know.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I love books about siblings because I've got five younger sisters and I just in lockdown reread I Capture the Castle. Have you read that?
Oh, I love that. Yes. It's the one she starts off with in the sink, doesn't she?
Yes.
That famous first line. Yeah, I really love that book.
And I think
five siblings is a lot, isn't it? So do you like Little Women?
Sorry, did I like Little Women?
Yes.
Yeah.
Little Women.
The next sister. Beth, we think she's called Beth, but she was a Jo. We had it read to us.
Yes.
I loved it.
Yes.
She hated it, so I sort of snuck off and read it on my own.
Oh,
but
really?
I do having what I loved the film so much, and I always felt a little bit. I think about this a lot, Meg's makeover, and I think because of having the big family, and my mum was quite strict about, you know, and there wasn't sort of a, it's like, you know, it's vaguely communist, like you'll wear the same thing and be glad. And I wanted a makeover like Meg.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And it broke my heart that everyone was like, oh, the silly tart, how dare she want a nice dress, how dare she want to sort of, and I felt that the sort of the lionizing of Jo, like it's not feminist to dismiss the feminine, but Saoirse Ronan and Greta Gerwig between them have made me rethink Jo.
I haven't reread it, so I read it as a child, so I don't remember it very clearly, apart from it being very sad because the best one died. But I haven't seen the film yet, so I will watch it. And then I think maybe I'll reread it.
Beth is your favourite?
Yeah. Or maybe it's because of how upset it made Jo, because now I do think Jo was my favourite. But I don't remember. I don't remember it very clearly. Sometimes, because when you read a lot, and I don't know if you find this, I don't even remember character names. Like, stuff just gets shoved out so quickly sometimes that I remember I really liked something but couldn't tell you why or who. I just go like, going, how did I spend all of that time with that in my hands? And now I'm going, the horse, I think?
I remember that. Not long after I read Norwegian Wood, Haruki Murakami, I was telling someone about, I've just read this book, it's great. Yeah. Like, what happens? Like, I couldn't tell you. There's a girl he likes and there's another girl.
There was definitely a man. Yeah.
They're on a train.
He drinks tea. He does stretches in the morning.
I do vaguely remember that.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters, May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
We'll be back with Sarah soon, but for now, here is a mini Steal of the Week. It's dumb, it's fun, and it's perfect for anyone whose concentration is shot to ribbons at the moment. It's The Stud by Jackie Collins. It's told by Tony, the titular stud, who is exhausted by the sexual demands of his glamorous employer Fontaine. He wants to pursue the sweet, refined Alexandra. If you want to drink masses of champagne and enjoy some love in an elevator, which has shag carpeting all the way up the walls, and I always do, and there's drink and drugs and sex happening all over the place, it's yummy. It's steamy. I am quoting directly from French and Saunders' sketch Lucky Bitches. Probably ends with us all buying leopard print onesies and backcombing our fringes. That's The Stud by Jackie Collins, published by Simon & Schuster. Now back to Sarah. I think I heard you on Adam Buxton's podcast talking about Catcher in the Rye with Richard Iwadi.
Yeah.
And that's a book that I struggled with.
Similarly, I mean, I would have been older than 15, maybe in my 20s when I read Catcher in the Rye, and it did not speak to me at all. And I didn't understand why people, especially if you felt kind of depressed and outside people, and that book was kind of forced into your hands by an adult going, this that understands you is Salinger. And then reading it late 30s, and then just, I honestly think it's the most astonishing story. It's the most astonishing. What's astonishing is how the character thinks one thing and the author is telling you something else. And it's just, it's so clever in how we misjudge people. We don't see them from a distance objectively. We see them up in the room. So we get things so wrong. And it is, he's an ultimate tragic character. He's the stage before an incel, I guess, in terms of his anger and how he blames things and his frustration. But it's really, really, really amazing.
What is the saddest?
Yeah. Oh, I just read the saddest. A Little Life.
Oh, my sister, one of them, was just recommending that to me.
So it's the most I've ever cried in a book, and it's very long. It's very incredibly written. There's four male main characters, and I felt like I knew them. Like, I still feel like, oh, if I was to go to America, I've got these friends like in New York, and I cried so much at one point. I was praying, and somebody came over to ask me if I was okay. Like, because I was crying so much, and I had to pretend to them that I was getting a divorce, because I thought, I can't say, oh, it's just this book, you don't understand what's happened to this. So I had to pretend, just like, oh, no, I'm just going through a divorce, I'm fine.
That's
the saddest book, I think, but it's amazing. But I think it puts people off, because what you hear is someone going, oh my God, this is the worst thing I've ever read. But they mean it's just so tragic. But it's really interesting about not just male sexuality, homosexuality, but male domestic violence, which you never really hear about. And I think for people who do experience male intimate partner violence, they're so struggling against the narrative, which is people who are affected are women. So let's sort that out first. And it's not in any way a political book, but in terms of, again, an empathy and an understanding and exercise, it's also like hugely important. And it's another one that's a good big doorstop for the lockdown, kind of 900 pages.
Wow. Yeah. Do you like that feeling of having a lot of book bang for your buck?
I like both. I like a quick book that goes straight on the red pile, where you feel like, oh, I've achieved something today, read it. And then there is something about, and like with the Hilary Mantel, when you're loving it and you go, I've still got 800 pages to go. That's a lovely feeling to go, oh, I've got a long time to enjoy this.
How do you organise your books? Do you have a system?
I kind of do. I don't let books I haven't read touch books I've read. So they're completely separate. And you don't get to go over to the red pile unless you're completely finished. So I've got some books that I'm halfway through that, like, maybe they're non-fiction, that have stayed on the to-read pile. I've got to read. And then I try to alternate fiction and non-fiction. But fiction is so much easier to read. I've always got a bigger pile of hard books I want to have read. But that aren't hugely enjoyable to read.
So what's on that pile?
Lots of books about economics. So I'm really interested in the theory about when you give everybody money. So, you know, universal...
Basic income.
Universal basic income. That's what I'm really interested in. And the theory of how... basically, economic theories that would make us have a more equal society and would stop the huge gap between... rich people and poor people. I'm really interested in those books, but then I find the actual maths and economics very dense, so I buy a lot of them and haven't read them.
I can imagine how I know sometimes I can read things and I can really like hear my brain creaking, be like, come on.
I once read, I got given a physics book by an ex-boyfriend years and years ago, and he was like, this will really help you understand string theory and particle physics. And I was like, brilliant, great. And I thought I'd just be able to read it and understand. And then, like, a little bit like when you pick up like a Stephen Hawking book, which was a bestseller. So you think, oh, I'll be able to understand this. And then you're at page three going like, okay, all of the words now don't mean anything to me. Like,
I've
you've already
read
lost
this
me.
Sentence 9 times and I understand it less every time. I really would love one day either to write something, or if someone else wants to write it, that'd be great, about the way characters in novels are with money. I love ballet shoes.
Oh.
And one of the things I loved about ballet shoes was that sort of, that they were quite young and they go and you know, have the sort of creative life and become performers. They're very talented, but it's very much like economic necessity. Like, oh, if we're in the panto, that's £1 a week and we need that, and we've got the lodgers and this sort of, that really appealed to me as a kid. I don't know why.
Oh, yeah, I think there's something about Keep the Aspergistra Flying, the George Orwell novel, where his poverty is described really brilliantly. That thing where you have 2 cigarettes left for the day. So you're literally thinking for 2 hours, I can't smoke one now because then I've only got one left and it's only 1 o'clock. And cups of tea and the fact that he's not allowed to eat or drink in his room. I read that book when I was very similarly poor. After my first job, I worked at the Millennium Dome, and then the Millennium Dome closed. And then I worked in a Wetherspoons, and basically after paying my rent, I had £10 a week. So I really did have that thing where you eke out and you can't just buy stuff in the supermarket. You have to go, okay, well, that, like, I used to buy bread and freeze it, and I knew how to defrost it so I could make it last a week. All these kind of things. I'm really interested in that too, because there are some books and there's some TV shows where money's irrelevant. If it's not a plot point, then people just buy stuff. Whereas for the majority of people, all of your life's decisions are, what can we get? What do we have left over? What we either saving for, or and also like borrowing money and things like that, like really common.
I do. It's something I think about the whole time, and it's such a silly, but 2 things I will never ever ever take for granted in my life, because there was a time when I couldn't. Like, I know now, I can go to a cash point, and touching all the wood, unless things change dramatically, if I can't get money out, it's because the cash point's broken. And before, it's because I was,
and if it got rejected in a shop. If you got rejected in a shop, it's, oh, you've got a problem, not, oh, God,
And this, the dancing.
I have that too, that not feeling, will it let me pay for this?
Yeah.
As you pay for something.
Like that, but you always feel that tightness in your chest and sort of say a little prayer to whoever. And
looking away from them, going, please, 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 please.
And like the luxury of contact lenses, and like, if a disposable one falls out, because I only wear them, I'm wearing them now, but it's only sort of, if it's just to give my face a break from the glasses, but you know, before it'd be like, I could maybe sort of have like 1 or 2 pairs a week, and if one like broke or went down a drain, I'm like, well, no, I'll just have to I wouldn't wear my glasses when I went out, though. I just not see.
Oh, really? How bad are your eyes?
Really quite bad.
Are you short-sighted, so you're fine reading?
Yeah, I can sort of hold things up close, but no, there are lots of it saved money on booze, because I already had that sort of tipsy, like, oh, it's all beautiful flashing lights around. But I think you'll say, right, and I get quite anxious now, and I think that's what, like, reading I Capture the Castle, and that's so, they're so good on that, and things like, but it's the way as well when there's a little bit of money, and things like, oh, we've got enough, I can have hot water for my bath, and that, the appreciated luxury.
Oh, I tell you who's interesting with money is Holly Golightly in Breakfast at Tiffany's, because she's a kind of sex worker. She goes out with men and they give her
$50 for the powder room.
Tips when she goes to the toilet. Yeah, so she goes to the toilet and they give her money for the toilet attendant, and that's essentially the money for her time. And it's a character traits that I don't have, but she's the kind of character in a novel who has nothing, but then will buy a fur coat and then has nothing again, and like she lives in this really risky way where you buy beautiful opulent things or really expensive champagne, and then the next day you've got no money to eat again.
And it's a kind of a disorder, isn't it, an emotional response to a sort of a need to kind of have power over your own powerlessness. There's a very different book, but a book that I loved so much, and I think it's so underrated, former podcast guest, Sarah Manning, Unsticky. It's very, very just smart and insightful, and it's about a woman in her 20s, and she works on a fashion magazine and earns about 12 grand a year and just cannot make it work, but she is surrounded by people who have so much inherited wealth, and they don't even like notice what their salary is, because they're all on like these sort of, they've got private incomes, and she's living in this world and trying to keep up.
And people who haven't had nothing, don't understand it. But it's almost the panic when you get the money and you know it's not going to last forever, it's going to go. It's actually simpler to go and it's gone again.
Mm.
Or you think that you don't deserve it, or, and yeah, all of it's so crazy. But it's like being addicted to alcohol or drugs, knowing that the thing that's worst for you is the thing that's most compelling.
The new Marion Keyes, I don't know if you've read that
yet. Oh yeah. I haven't. No, my two of my friends have just read it. I think that's another really good lockdown one, isn't it? Because it's so, my friend Aisling just read it and just absolutely loved it.
It is fantastic. And the emotional side of bulimia is covered so well. And it's one of the characters is an adult woman with a family. And it's just the way it's so brilliant. And I think it's because Marion Keyes has, you know, written so movingly about sort of her own sort of alcoholism and, you know, addiction.
Yes, yeah.
But I've never seen it sort of covered in that way before, where it's like the opposite of all of those like YA books I read when I was 12 in the library, that's like dying to be thin and sort of...
Because people don't understand that in so many ways it's a very normal behaviour, kind of gone slightly too far in one direction, but it isn't a really extreme... People think that, a woman looks at a woman on a magazine and then goes, okay, I'm going to stick my fingers down my throat, like as if it's always caused. It's such an interesting thing and such a difficult thing for so many people to live with, because it's so common as well. And that's another one of those things, bulimia, where that it's completely kind of ignored when it happens in men.
Yeah.
On RuPaul's Drag Race a couple of times, a couple of the queens have talked about their relationship with bulimia. Because of course they live in and work in an environment which is so focused on what you look like and aesthetics as well.
And I imagine too, it's such a pressurized environment and the highs and lows are so dramatic. And again, it's another situation where you feel like so much of your own what you want to do is like, it's outside your control and out of your hands. And it's a thing you can control when you can't control anything else. Unrelated, would you ever write fiction?
That's what I'm doing at the moment. I've just started writing a novel, but it's very early and I haven't pitched it yet. I've written about 10,000 words, but I've planned it out and I've wanted to write this book for a really long time, but it feels very much like we all get, imposter syndrome is what I've got. And so I love books so much that it feels very difficult to start it, but I just have to concentrate on the story at the moment. I'm desperate to write fiction.
I'm desperate to read this. I don't know if it helps or not, but I wrote my first novel and it's coming out in spring 2021, if we're all still here then.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much, listeners.
At least it's not now. At least you've got a little while and things will have settled down by the time it comes out.
I hope so. It took me so long because I've written non-fiction books, but the idea, partly I was terrified of having to write the whole thing first, but I really had that, this is all I've ever wanted to do, how can I possibly presume to, I can make something up, but I don't think I can make something up where you get to the ending and think that ending warranted me spending 90,000 words here.
Yeah, I think that's it. It's going, I'm not trying to write the best book in the world, I'm just trying to write this story. But it feels completely different to non-fiction, because non-fiction feels like a conversation. Still writing a book feels like it does feel like an arrogant thing to do, but my job is stand-up, which is really arrogant, because essentially stand-up is going, okay, you should listen to me, and a book is like, you should listen to me and can you carry me around in your handbag and spend hours of your life listening. So it's so arrogant, so of course we struggle.
I feel that way about podcasts and that sort of demanding people's ears. But I was thinking about you telling stories about your imaginary hamster and Lynn Reed Banks and Houdini. Yeah. And was that, do you think that was the genesis of a stand-up, of taking something that had a sort of root in truth and being able to project and twist and dream? And
It's exactly that. So I was a pathological liar at school, and that is what became stand-up comedy. And now I'm very honest in my real life. Like, I'm very much about truth and authenticity, and that's how you connect with people. And but as a teenager, I wanted people to like me so much that I thought if I said certain things that would make it happen. And absolutely, I know that that's the storytelling part of my brain. And stand up is exactly that. Like, you know, when you go into a shop and someone's rude and you think an hour later what you should have said, stand up comedy, you say that you said that. Stand up comedy, you go on stage, you go, I was in a shop, they said this, and I was like, duh, 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 and everyone laughs and claps. And that isn't what happened. Like, you get to, it's an improved truth. And so, yeah, it's exactly the same part of the brain, I think.
Oh, well, I'm going to, as a fangirl, nerdily ask you about something, because I think it's one of the best jokes I've seen in my life, and it made me laugh so hard. And it's because I'm like, this is exactly what happened to me. I saw you doing stand-up, but it's a joke that you did about you going on a breakup trip to Costa Rica and getting on the plane.
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
Thinking, oh, hold on, why is it 14 hours? I thought we were going to Spain.
Yeah. I thought I booked the holiday really quickly after a breakup in like a lunch break. I was filming a pilot. And then I thought, I don't have a boyfriend. I don't have anywhere to live. I'll just go away. And I booked it on the lunch break and just didn't look about where Costa Rica was, because I thought it was the Costa del Sol, essentially. Yeah. And I told that story on Would I Lie to You? And then the Costa Rica tourist board used a clip of it to show how stupid Europeans were. As someone said to me on Facebook, have you seen this? And it's like the Costa Rica tourist board's Facebook saying they're so stupid, they don't even know we're not in Spain.
On that note, I think that's the perfect place to end. I've had so much fun. I'm sorry about the crackly sound.
Oh, but me it's just too. Been,
I absolutely, absolutely cannot wait for your book. And yeah, please know that there's at least one other person who, like, when I was 10,000 words in, I was like, I can't do this. Am I to do this?
Yeah.
But, you know, I love your voice and I love your writing so much, and I think it's going to be wonderful.
Oh, bless you. Thank you so much. And best of luck with yours as well when it comes out. I hope all of the kind of the world is much more normal and you get to do lots of promo, and that's very exciting. You should be hugely proud of yourself. It was lovely talking to you, Daisy.
Really lovely talking to you, Sarah. Thank you so much. Huge thanks to Sarah for shelf isolating with us, and do try to get your hands on her first book, Animal, and Sarah's latest, Sex, Power, Money. Like her, it's funny and it's smart, and it will absolutely change the way you see the world. I'm Daisy Buchanan. Thank you so much for listening. Your Book is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Follow us on social media at YBooked. That's the letter Y, booked. I hope you're all keeping as safe and sane and well and cheerful as it's possible to at the moment. Please keep reading. I'll see you next time.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.